Isabel reminded us this morning that in the Tibetan tradition, this day is considered the day when the Buddha gave his first teaching, right? And I think in the Zen tradition, although we don't say that, we would agree. That today is the day of the Buddha's first teaching. However, the difference is that we would say that every day. Every day is the day of the Buddha's first teaching. So today is very much the first day of the Buddha's teaching. And that teaching is always the same. And that teaching is always that the true nature of reality or of beings or things or phenomena is just this, just as they are. And then everything else we say after that is just so that we can be helped to see that, to experience that. And there have been, as we know, written millions of words, hundreds and thousands of books, and practices have been created, and schools, and temples, and drawings, and paintings, and traditions, and clothing, and appearances, and objects, all coming back to that first day, that first teaching, which is right now, here, of things as they are. Last night, for the first time, I believe, in one of our retreats, I introduced what is a usual technique, a usual occurrence in most of the retreats that I lead and participate in, which is for those people working with a special technique, with a particular technique, not a special technique, which is koan practice, it's important for them to have a regular moment when they can put that into practice in a very intense way. And that's what I introduced last night for those people who are working on koans. Now, I realize that many of you don't know what koans are and that you didn't know what was going on, and I fully had the intention to explain to you today. And in fact, in the same way that every day is the first day of the Buddha's teaching, all of you could have come last night, because you all are working on koans, but you don't know that. And I'll clarify that for you. From the other point of view, of course, no, you're not. And in the same way that for the historical Buddha, there was a moment in time when he first spoke. That's true as well. So, what are koans? You probably wonder. And you may have heard of it in or read about it. It's a practice that is very easily co-opted into the popular culture with phrases like, what is the sound of one hand clapping, which many people have heard. And in the popular imagination, these are considered kind of silly, funny, clever, a riddle that needs to be solved. And in fact, that's not what they are at all. And when I say that everyone is working on a koan, our life itself is a koan. It's a mystery. It's a riddle that we can't figure out. It's the greatest koan. It's the finest koan. It's the best koan for each of us. It's the most organic. It's the most intimate. It's the most pure koan. Our life. It's difficult to work with, however, because it is so intimate. It is so close. We can't even begin to approach it. We are caught up in it. So in the Chinese tradition, which then became the Japanese tradition, and then which has now become, we don't really have a name for it, it will take a few hundred years, I think, before we come to terms with what we're doing here in the West. For the moment, we just call it the Western tradition. We use these tools that were developed in this way in China. The Chinese mentality was different from the Indian mentality, which is where the Buddha originated. And the Indian mentality was much more esoteric, mystical, intellectual, elaborate, colorful, a lot of imagination. The Chinese mentality was much more grounded, much simpler, much more practical. The culture was different. There wasn't a lot of flights of fantasy and colors. And this technique grew out of that, also influenced by Taoism and Confucianism, which were present in China when these teachings arrived. It's a very brief little history of how this came about. At the time when these techniques began to be developed, which was 8th, 9th century, generally the approach to things as they are, as we say, had been inherited from the Indian tradition and was based on sacred texts that they considered sacred, what we call sutras, which sutra is just a thread. It's like what we have, at least in French, when you stitch someone up when they've been hurt, it's le point de suture. In Portuguese,
sutura.
Same kind of word. Yeah. And those words have their origin in the same word, in the Sanskrit sutra. So there were these sacred threads that were to be followed. Well, something a little different happened in China, because someone came along out of India and came to China with the teachings, and he said, doesn't have anything to do with any sacred texts. Things as they are, experiencing things as they are, is outside of the sacred texts. No special words, no special techniques. The Buddha's teaching is here and now, in things as they are, outside of the texts. This was scandalous to a lot of people. In the West, much later, people were burned at the stake for saying things like that. The Inquisition, no, you couldn't say things like that. So this guy comes along and says this. He was not burned at the stake, but he wasn't really welcomed. However, people started paying attention, everyday people, and followed him. He passed the teachings on to others, etc., etc. There still was a divide, however, in China between the North and the South. In the South, which where these new teachings were arriving, through this person whose name, he was a prince, his name was Bodhidharma. In the South, that was spreading, this things as they are. Teaching outside the sacred texts. In the North, however, they were still very strict, kind of like, you know, in Portugal, isn't it like that? The North is a bit more conservative than the South. And I've heard this and haven't experienced it myself. And that situation was very strong. In the middle of all this, along comes someone who is an expert in one of the sutras, which is called the Diamond Sutra. And a beautiful text that elaborates upon things as they are, but in a very beautiful way. And one of the key lines in that, key lines among many key lines, is the mind of the past is ungraspable or unattainable. The mind of the present is ungraspable. The mind of the future is ungraspable. There was a fellow in China at this time, in the North, who was an expert on this text. He knew more than anyone about this text. He was very erudite, very cultured, studied a lot. He was a Buddhist monk. He devoted his life to this text and teaching it. And he had heard about these heretics in the South. And he was determined to go to the South and eliminate them and show them the truth of this text, that this was where the real teaching lie. And so he set off, and in these days in China at this time, sacred texts were scrolls and heavy, you know, and so he had to carry this around on his back. And he went, he made his journey from the North to the South, and along the way would tell people all about the sutra and convince them how beautiful it was and have them memorize it. And he could never find anyone who was as expert on it as he was. He knew the insides and the outsides of this text. And one day he's arrived in the South and he stops. He's hungry and thirsty, and there's an old woman with a little stand beside the road, and she's selling tea and cakes. And so he arrives, and he orders his tea and cakes, and she says to him, what do you have on your back? And he said, oh, I have the Diamond Sutra. And she said, oh, really? What are you doing? And she could hear from his accent that he was from the north and probably from the way he was dressed. She said, what are you doing? And he said, well, he told her his story, that he was an expert, he was the most eminent scholar in the Diamond Sutra in the land, and that he was coming to spread the word and to meet other people, discuss the Diamond Sutra, and that he had heard about these heretics and their teaching that it was outside, the truth was outside of the scriptures. And the woman said, oh, okay. Well, I've heard that in the Diamond Sutra it says the mind of the past is ungraspable, the mind of the present is ungraspable, and the mind of the future is ungraspable. I said, oh, yeah, that's true. It does say that. He was surprised this old woman selling tea and cakes knew that. And she said, so, with which mind do you take these cakes? If you can answer, I offer the tea and cakes to you for free. Well, he didn't know what to say. And he thought a bit, and he paid for the cakes and the tea. And he said to her, is there a Zen master in this neighborhood? And she said, oh, yes, yeah. Just up the hill there, about 5 kilometers, there's a guy. And he said, okay. And he went to see this guy. I'm telling you all of this because this is a koan, okay? And it's in this little collection here that I have, but I don't really need to read it. I will refer to it if I forget a detail. And so he arrives at this temple, which was not anything spectacular, and he meets the master, and the master invites him in and invites him to have some dinner with him, and they talk for hours and hours about the Diamond Sutra, and the master knows pretty much as their names are Toku-san is the guy carrying the sutra on his back, and Ryotan is the master. So Ryotan, the master, knows pretty much as Toku-san knows. They're having this nice conversation like two people who really love something and know a lot about it can have. You know, it's very fruitful. And then it's beginning to get late, and so the Toku-san will stay at the temple, but in another building, and says, oh, it's getting late, I think I should go. And so he picks up his things, and he goes to the door, and he looks outside, and it's black. And he said, oh, it's dark out there. Kind of like here when I walk back to my where I'm staying through the forest at night. So it's dark. And Ryotan says, oh yes, yes, of course, and lights a candle for him and gives him the candle. And just as Toku-san is turning to go out into the darkness with his candle, Ryotan blows the candle out. And in the story, as often in these stories, at that moment, Toku-san awakens, we say. He has great realization in a much more ordinary way, we would say he sees things as they are. The story goes on that the next day, the master Ryotan invites Toku-san to come to a gathering like this, and says, presents Toku-san to the other people, saying, here is someone who will go on to become a great master someday, whatever. And Toku-san comes before them and says something like, I will never again doubt the words of all the great masters. I will never again doubt the teaching. And he burns his scrolls of the very spectacularly lights them on fire and burns his scrolls. He does go on, and he reappears in different stories that we use as koans. And we kind of follow him through his life. He has become one of the key characters in these stories that we tell. So when I say this is a koan, and I purposely tell you the koan before explaining to you what a koan is. The word koan means a public case. You know, it's kind of like in law, where you have case law, and there are cases that are used as examples to prove, as proof in other cases. And koans have that same effect, in the sense that they are incidents, stories, phrases, situations that happened, or that some teacher has had meaning for a teacher, and are then used as tools for others. So we use these stories as tools in order to see things as they are, in order to experience them, things as they are. Usually, everything is covering up this nothing of things as they are. And koan, a koan like this, is just a tool to help us lift that veil of everything that is covering nothing. And at that moment, nothing is covering everything. You see it switches. And this, we can almost say, is an accident when that switch occurs. But we can cultivate the ground to make that possibility more real. The reality, the possibility of that happening more real. And that's what koans attempt to do. So, as I say, these originated in 8th or 9th century China, and they still are alive and thriving today. And they've been formalized into curriculum. There are hundreds and hundreds of them. And at the same time, every moment is a koan. Like I say, every moment of your life, every incident, every situation, every relationship is a koan. It's a public case that you can use as a tool, that can be used as a tool. It's fuel for the fire, I could say. Now, in this particular case of Toku-san, what's going on here? What does he realize? What, when the candle is blown out, what happens? Why, when the old woman says to him, "With which mind will you take these cakes?" is he speechless? What does it mean the teaching is outside of the sacred texts? The truth, the historical truth, is that teaching outside of the scriptures in China then eventually became what we call Chan Buddhism, and was then eventually transmitted to Japan and Korea and Vietnam, and eventually became Zen, and then came to the West. Of course, there are other branches of Buddhism that are transmitted as well. I'm just giving you the story of how this originated. And it doesn't mean that the, quote, sacred texts are not respected or are ignored. It's just that they're not necessary. They can be helpful, sure, but the living, breathing reality of things as they are is right here. It's not in some book. It's not in some text. It's not yesterday. It's not tomorrow. It's right now. There is no other ground for awakening than here. That's all that the whole thing, that's all it's about. And then, of course, there are different practices and techniques and schools and uniforms and objects and all kinds of things. But the basic truth is that. So koans are used as a tool to help us realize that. And they have this enigmatic quality about them, because usually our mind is caught up in, like I said, everything. So it's caught up in making sense, in understanding, in categorizing, in following logic, in making things coherent, in keeping out the chaos. Making things smart or safe or attractive to our preferences. And koans go right to the heart of that and rip out the rug from underneath it. Because if someone says to you, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" immediately you think of, okay, clapping, two hands, one hand, oh, so maybe it's this, some sort of logic, some sort of deduction, some sort of trying to figure it out. But that's not at all what it's about. So, and there are many, many koans, as I said. You know, there are simpler ones, or maybe not. You know, sometimes it seems simple to someone and someone else it's not. I work with people, for years and years I've worked with people on koans, and koans that I had particular difficulty with, that were just like a battle for me, for someone else, no problem. Others, which for me were no problem, people struggle with sometimes. It all has to do with everyone. Each of us individually has our own experience. There is no one set response and no one set experience. But it all comes back to things as they are. So, you know, another one. How do you go straight on a road that has 99 turns? So then you can start. You have all of your ideas about what is straight, what is a turn, why 99, why do I care? All kinds of things. And that's part of the process. That's part of the emptying out of this stuff, of the everything. That's part of the, or maybe we could say it's like chopping away at the veil that is there. And there is no special talent required. In fact, it's better if it's easier for children, for example, are very good with koans. They have not much trouble. You know, not a lot of intellectual baggage wrapped up in it. Of course, they are not aware to the same extent, possibly, of what's at stake. But if we have a lot of ideas in our head, that means we have more ideas we have to evacuate. Like Toku-san. You know, he was an expert. And as the Japanese master Suzuki famously said, the guy who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, famously said that in the beginner's mind, everything is possible. In the experts, not much is possible. So Toku-san arrives as an expert. And so he has a lot of baggage he's carrying around, literally and figuratively. Now, he makes this dramatic gesture in the end of burning the scrolls. He doesn't have to do that, actually. Sometimes people say this was, as we follow him through his career, this was the green Toku-san. He was very green, very, very zealous, you could say. And so it called for a grandiose action, burning the sutras. In fact, it's not necessary. And then he goes on in his career in another story. If you say yes, he hits you 30 times with his stick. If you say no, he hits you 30 times with his stick. He's still in his green mode. Zealous. And then later on, when he's an old man, he arrives with his bowls to eat, and the cook, the young cook, says, "What are you doing here, old man? It's not time for lunch. The bell didn't ring yet." And he says, "Okay." He turns around and goes away. He's no longer the fierce hit you in the face. So, every one of the koans, every one of the stories, every individual who works with them, it's all about this day, the first day of the Buddha's teaching. It all comes back to that. And the content, we could say, of each is that. However, because every day is different, it always looks different. And because each individual is different, it's always experienced differently, although the content is the same. Things as they are. Now, things as they are can become a concept. Just this can become a concept. And it does very quickly. And I'm speaking from personal experience when I say this. I would say to my teacher, in response to every koan, just this. And she would say, no, and ring the bell. I must say I didn't do that every time because I learned quickly that that wasn't going to work. And so someone else's response is not your response. There's another famous one where the teacher's teaching, and I think I've told these stories a lot, some of you have heard them many times, but the teacher's teaching is this. And there's a boy who has been studying with him, and one day a visitor comes, and the visitor says to the boy, "What is your master's teaching?" And the boy goes like this. And the master heard about this, and he summoned the boy, and he said, when the visitor asked you what my teaching was, what did you say, the boy? And the master sliced his finger off. And as the boy, this was a different culture than ours, okay? Don't worry, I don't slice any fingers off. And the boy went screaming, running out of the room, and just as he got to the door, the master called out his name. And the boy turned around, and at that moment, another great realization. So it's not about repeating. So when I'm sitting there telling my teacher, just this, just this, just this, it's like the boy just holding up his finger. No. That's not what it is. That's not what the teaching is. Things as they are change all the time. So, any questions or comments or any observations about Tokusan and his cakes?
In some sense, it seems that 20 years ago or something, it was much easier to just express just this. Now maybe I understand it better. Or not, but the dropping, the you understand that just this, but you don't express it. You let the it's not courage. It's something that it's missing. You understand, but you don't just do the movement. And it seems that, like you said, the children, I remember that some years ago it was, in some sense, of course, in some ways, much easier.
Yeah, and in fact, it's the understanding that complicates it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Literally, the word, I don't know in Portuguese how it works, but understanding, it's as if we're standing under something. And that really is heavy. You know? It gets in the way. We're not free. And that's why there's so many of the koans. Because every time the rug is pulled out again and again. And then we think we got it. We understand it. Yeah. And then do it again. And we don't get it again. And we do it again and again and again and again. And every time there's that word, this word that we say in the Orioki at the end, I think we Svaha.
Mm-hmm.
Svaha. This is like, we translate it as like, whoa. Wow, it's a really amazing thing. So every time it's that, and then it starts over again. The understanding, we're standing under it, and it's caught, and then we have to have that rug pulled out again and again. So yes, I understand.
About the koan that you're talking about, Joko-san. This, well, maybe this is my mind trying to understand. when he sees the darkness, and then the master gives him the flame, the light, and then blows away. This is almost like the experience of what you were saying the other day, cupness and non-cupness. It's just.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, it's about this? Because he was holding on the uncupness, somehow, on the unrestable mind, and the woman was calling him for the grasping, for the reality of things. So he was always put in challenge of this to realities, the form and formless. It's about this.
Well, and then what does he realize when the light goes out? What is his realization? It's true, he sees the contrast, he sees the light and the dark, and he's been confronted again by this ungraspable, and he's grasping to the grasp, to the ungraspable, maybe, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
What does he see, though? What does he realize? That's the question.
He sees there is no difference.
In
some way.
And what? How does he?
Having the candle or not doesn't change the darkness outside.
Yeah. So you're all. I like this. You're all going with it. Yes.
Of course, his perception is different. His perception is different because with light he sees, without light he doesn't see. If he's standing,
and what is
when
seeing?
The light goes out, the feet, the floor is still under his feet. He probably would feel it. I don't know. I'm just
good. Go with these things.
It changes the perception. It doesn't change how
the perception of his eyes, maybe, yes. His visual perception.
The visual perception.
If he was standing barefooted. The perception, the floor is the floor.
Yeah, things don't change, it's just his perception that it's more
part of his perception. Yes, even just part of his perception that changes.
Go with it.
To be enlightened. Enlightened the word of for knowledge. Light, enlightened, could it be.
Mm-hmm. And what does that entail? What does that enlightenment entail?
Well, he realized, suddenly realized he had no
all that enlightenment he carried on his back was nothing, because he was lacking some light. Now I'm saying the candle. I'm working with the word light here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It can also be a metaphor of a path. It's dark, there's no path, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And you're all it's dark, I can't go. And he gives a light just to show that he's carrying power. Mm-hmm. And then it flows, there's no path. You have to drop it.
And then light.
It's like the voidness, like with which mind are you eating the cakes? Gatte, no mind. Or just. Okay.
So, with which mind are we eating the cakes?
With the mind that it's no mind. It's both.
Gatte.
Parasam gatte. Good. Good, guys. Good. See? So, see what happens? It gets under your skin. Sometimes it would happen when my teacher would give a talk on a story like this, and I just couldn't not stay with it. And I became obsessed with it. And so I would sit there with it, and then I wasn't supposed to be working on that koan. I had another one I was supposed to be working on. But I couldn't not. I just became obsessive about it. And so then I would go and I would work on that one.
But working is about this, what we do. It's this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Because in a way, mm-hmm. it's about going out of the concepts. But on another way, we are also working with logic and koans.
Well, part of the process of working with koans is everything is included. Right? It's like saying, you know, I will build a house without bricks. You need bricks to build a house, you know. So, our whole life is dealing with concepts and ideas and patterns, mental things, and whatever. But like I said, that stuff tends to obscure the nothing. And the house that doesn't have bricks, the house that is without bricks, our true home is without bricks. So working with koans is you have to go through all this stuff. So you go through, you work through it all. And you come, and you it's important, that's why the role of the teacher is that you work with them on it. So you would come to me and you would say this stuff, and then there would be a dialogue. Wouldn't resemble any dialogue that you usually would have, but there's a dialogue that goes on. And I have no idea when you arrive what you will present. And you don't either, really. You may probably plan it, because usually that's what happens. You plan it out and you don't come until you feel kind of safe about what you're going to say. You think, okay, I know, or I don't know, but I know what I don't know, and so I'm going to tell her this. Well, that soon is out the window, too, because that doesn't take into account what I will say. So, there is something in that thing. It's like this, you know, so... That's part of our talk today, the geese, you know. And on the tape, we probably will hear that. And so there's this thing that goes on. Yes, so that's what we're working on. This. And of course, it appeals to the mind, to the concept, but it's very tricky because that's not where the response will come from.
But we would have to do it anyway, even though we know that. Not where the answer is coming from.
Well,
do you have? I mean,
there is no set rule about what you have to do and not have to do. But in my experience, pretty much yes, because that's who you are.
building the house without bricks. Since I don't know how to build a house without bricks, yeah. I don't have to use it, even
exactly.
though
yeah.
someone said build it without.
Yeah. And you can't do away with them unless you have them. You can't take away the bricks unless you have the bricks to take away. So you have to first go through and see those thoughts and concepts and ideas and beliefs and patterns of logic and everything, the dualities and the frustrations and the humiliation and the fear.
That's the whole point.
All of it, yeah, you have to go through it all. Yeah.
Even when I'm using the bricks, I know I shouldn't be using them because I'm not supposed to be using them.
Well, but if you're thinking that, then you're not really using them either. it's a lose-lose situation.
Yeah.
Or a win-win situation, actually. So...